opposite. So I'll talk about classical simulations of certain classes of quantum circuits. Okay, so some motivation. I guess an ultimate question that this work is ultimately about is, you know, does BQP have polynomial time classical simulations? Of course, most of us think that the answer is no to this question. I've met a few serious people who think the answer might be yes, but anyway, we don't know. And of course, it's quite a fundamental problem to understand somehow what the relationship is between these two classes. And this is what this work is about. So assuming that BQP is different from P, you may also ask, you know, what are the essential quantum mechanical ingredients that give quantum computers their power or that distinguish classical from quantum computing? So is it entanglement? Is it interference? Is it non-commutativity? You know, or can you make a precise statement that somehow delineates the border between classical and quantum? And also somehow, what are essential ingredients that a good quantum algorithm should have? So we'll try to address these questions by analyzing the quantum Fourier transform. Of course, as you know, this is a very important component in many well-known quantum algorithms, like Shor, hidden subgroup problem, phase estimation, and so on. So certainly this is one of the key ingredients in many quantum algorithms. So sometimes people even say that the quantum Fourier transform is somehow the main quantum element in Shor's factoring algorithm, whatever that really means, or that it should be somehow the reason why this algorithm cannot be simulated classically. So you want to understand somehow how this works. And the question that we ask is, are there some non-trivial conditions under which the quantum Fourier transform has efficient classical simulations, and what are such conditions? So of course, by the very start of the problem, the objective is quite orthogonal to quantum algorithm design. So we really want to identify situations where the quantum Fourier transform is not useful, so to say. But the idea is to get some kind of complementary insights or a new way of looking at the problem that may tell us somehow where quantum Fourier transforms will be useful, where they will not be useful, maybe to have an idea of a new primitive for quantum algorithms and so on. And also somehow given that the quantum Fourier transform has been used quite successfully in so many quantum algorithms, algorithms that try to simulate this quantum Fourier transform might also lead to new classical algorithms for whatever problems that the quantum Fourier transform has been used for. So these are somehow the motivations of this work. So there has been a little bit of, or some previous work on classical simulations of quantum Fourier transforms. As far as I know, there are three papers that have addressed this problem. All three of them appeared around the same time, and they have rather similar results. So the first one was by Aharonov, Landau, and Makowski in 2006. So they show the following. If you have a quantum circuit where you apply the approximate quantum Fourier transform on a product input state and where you measure immediately after that in some product basis, then this quantum circuit has a classical simulation. It is not quite efficient. It is somehow quasi-polynomial time, as you might call that. So this is the scaling n to the power log n over there. Shortly thereafter, there was a work by Joran and Short, which look at the same setting, but they achieve a truly polynomial time classical simulation. They also looked at a bit more general situation. So whereas Aharonov et al. Just looked at a single application of the quantum Fourier transform, and immediately after that, a measurement, Joran and Short also looked at quantum circuits that are somehow a bit broader that contain the Fourier transform in there. And the idea is to look at logarithmic depth, nearest neighbor quantum circuits that are somehow interspersed with a constant number of quantum Fourier transforms. So this means somehow you look at a circuit of this kind. So the gates are nearest neighbor and the depth of the circuit is log n. So not the size, but depth. And then you throw in at arbitrary places, let's say here and so on. So just globally in the entire circuit, a constant number of quantum Fourier transforms. And also this quantum circuit will have an efficient classical simulation, as they showed. And then there was a third paper a bit later by Dan Brown, who looked at a similar setting. So he looked at the quantum Fourier transform acting on some product input state, and then followed immediately by a standard basis measurement. So pretty much like the first setting. He also extended that to certain entangled input states like matrix product states and so on. He also had a fully polynomial time classical simulation. So there is a common element to these three results. Namely, the simulation is based on the fact that all the circuits that appear in these works have a very restricted structure that somehow resembles a tree-like structure. So basically, the tree width of all these circuits is small. And if this is the case, then you can apply tensor network methods to do the simulation. So these tensor network methods, they don't really care about what the gates look like, but just at how they are ordered together somehow. What's also interesting is that these circuits these restricted circuit classes that look like trees, that they cannot generate lots of entanglement. So ultimately, these simulations are based on the intuition that none of these circuits can generate lots of entanglement, you know, entanglement specified in some concrete sense. But this is somehow what lies beneath that. Okay, that was very roughly what has been done. So in this work, we have a new classical simulation of quantum Fourier transforms. It is quite different from what is done before. So on the one hand, we don't care really what the circuit structure will look like. So it can be arbitrary. On the other hand, we will care about what gates we applied. So the allowed gates that appear in the circuits, they have to be very special, similar to the Gottesman-Dill theorem. And in fact, this Gottesman-Dill theorem will be, so this deals with Clifford circuits, as I will explain later. This will be a special case of this result. So it's really a generalization of the Gottesman-Dill theorem that is obtained here. And then of course, since the circuit structure can be arbitrary, these tensor network methods, they will not work. And at the same time, entanglement produced in these circuits can also be high. So the simulation will not be based on entanglement related methods, so to say, because these methods, they do not work for the Gottesman-Dill theorem. Anyway, okay, so also different from previous works, the quantum Fourier transforms we will look at, they can be defined over arbitrary finite abelian groups, whereas the other previous results just looked at somehow the standard quantum Fourier transform over the integers modulo 2 to the n, so to say. And perhaps also different from these other works is that the whole setting in which these circuits that I will define are situated, they are quite related to a more quantum algorithmic setting. So they are circuits that you might want to think about using them in a quantum algorithm. Of course, the simulation result says that you shouldn't, but you might. Okay, so the outline of the rest of the talk, I'll first define the circuits that I will consider. They're called normalizer circuits. Then I'll state the main result, which says that these circuits can be simulated efficiently classically. I'll briefly discuss a relation to the factoring algorithm, and I'll give a brief sketch of the proof. Okay, so these circuits, so what are they about? So the central object, so to say, in this definition is a finite abelian group that is given as a direct product of cyclic groups. So here ZD represents the additive group of integers modulo D. And you have a direct product of M of those guys. An arbitrary group element in G is just an M tuple where GI belongs to ZDI. And addition of group elements is just component wise. So it's a fundamental result that every finite abelian group is isomorphic to a direct product of this kind. So in that sense, the class of groups that we consider is quite general. But there is an important restriction here, namely that we assume that this decomposition is explicitly given to us, right? So generally speaking, if you have if you're looking at a finite abelian group given to you in some form, figuring out what this corresponding decomposition is can be a hard task. And so we assume that this decomposition is really given as an input. Okay, and then with every such group, one associates a Hilbert space. This is rather standard. So the dimension of the Hilbert space will be the same as the number of elements in the group. One starts by defining a local Hilbert space, Hi, that has basis states labeled by the elements of the integers modulo Di, so it's a Di dimensional space. Then of these spaces, one takes the tensor product, like here, and this will be the total Hilbert space that we will look at. And of course, one can make a basis of this Hilbert space by making tensor products of the basis vectors in the individual Hilbert spaces. And then one ends up with a basis where each element of the basis is labeled by a group element like this. Okay, so that's the Hilbert space we will consider. Just to give some examples. So you could look at as the group Z2, so m copies of that. So here a group element is just a bit string of n bits, and the group operation is addition modulo 2. Each of these local Hilbert spaces is just a single qubit with the standard basis, and the total Hilbert space will be just a system of m qubits with the standard computational basis. You could also look at the group Z2 to the m. So this is the integers modulo 2 to the m. So this is a single cyclic group, and correspondingly, the Hilbert space will, so this decomposition will just have a single factor with basis vectors labeled by the elements 0 to 2 to the n minus 1. So these of course, these Hilbert spaces, they are isomorphic, but here it's important that the tensor, so the direct product structure of the group induces a factorization here into m qubits, whereas it does not do that in this other group. And this will have an implication on what kind of operations we allow on these Hilbert spaces. Okay, so the idea is now to define certain types of unitary operators acting on this Hilbert space. So we will have three types of operators. Each of those we will generically call a normalizer gate. So we will have quantum Fourier transforms, so-called automorphism gates, and so-called quadratic phase gates. So I will define now what these things mean. Okay, so quantum Fourier transforms, that's just the standard definition. So you have a quantum Fourier transform over the ith cyclic group in a decomposition, just as in the standard way, right? I guess you all know that. The quantum Fourier transform over the entire group G is just given by the tensor product of these m individual quantum Fourier transforms. So this will be an allowed normalizer gate. We will also allow the inverse quantum Fourier transform and also so-called partial quantum Fourier transforms. That means that in this tensor product, you're allowed to replace whatever subset of Fourier transforms by the identity. And also this will be an allowed operation. Okay. A second family of operators are so-called automorphism gates. So an automorphism of the group is basically an isomorphism from the group to itself. This means that the map has to be invertible and it has to respect the group operation. So if you add two elements and apply the map A, then it's the same as first applying the map A and then adding the map. With every such automorphism, we define a unitary operator that acts as a permutation on the standard basis by just applying this automorphism. Okay. Then the third family of gates that is allowed, that's a bit more tricky. These are called quadratic phase gates. So the basic object here is a quadratic function, which is defined as follows. So it's a function from the group to the set of non-zero complex numbers that satisfies the property given here in this equation. So if you act with this quadratic function Q on sums of elements of the group, then it does not quite factorize, but you end up with this extra function B there. And this function has to be what you could call bilinear, meaning that if you look at what happens to a sum G plus G prime in the first argument, then this somehow factorizes. And the same for the second argument. So you could say somehow be linear in a multiplicative way. Okay, so any function that satisfies this property is called quadratic. And then we allow gates that that are diagonal in the standard basis by means of applying this quadratic function. So it's not obvious from this definition that that this operator is in fact unitary. So for this to happen, this Q have to be complex phases, but you can show that this is always the case. So this Q is always a complex phase. And in fact, it will always be a certain root of unity with power 2g, right? So it's that's not, I mean, it's rather straightforward to show. I can give you some intuition on why this is the case by looking at quadratic functions where this function b here is trivial, so where this is the identity. So I have this here. So suppose that you look at a simple instance of this quadratic function where sums really factorize and where this b is identical to one. So this is an allowed bilinear function. So these types of functions, they're just basically homomorphisms from the group G to the multiplicative group of complex numbers. Okay, so why should such a function always be a root of unity? Well, that's quite simple. So using this on the zero element, you find that this has to be true. And since by definition, these function values should be non-zero, this means that zero will have to be mapped to one, right? So this is written again here. And now you use that if you have whatever group element, you multiply it with itself g times, where g is the order of the group, then you arrive at zero, basically saying that the order of every element divides the order of the total number of elements in the group. And then here you use that that this function factorizes on sums, moving this cardinality to the exponent, and this somehow shows you that such a function value should be a g-th root of unity. Okay, and therefore a complex phase. And then for arbitrary quadratic functions, you know, the proof is a bit longer, but somehow the properties you use are similar in spirit. Okay, so these are the gates that we allow. So just to give you some examples of what these things amount to for some concrete groups. So let's first look at the example Z2 times Z2 times Z2, so m times. As we saw before, the corresponding Hilbert space is just a system of m qubits with computational basis. So it's very easy to show that the quantum Fourier transform over a single copy of Z2 is just a Hadamard gate. And therefore, the quantum Fourier transform over the entire group will just be a tensor product of n Hadamard gates. And then a partial quantum Fourier transform is just, you know, a tensor product of Hadamards and identities. Okay. So what about automorphism gates? Well, as I said before, so an automorphism has to be an invertible map from the group to itself that respects the group structure. In this simple case, it simply means that you have a linear operation on this group G, which has the structure of a vector space over Z2. So an automorphism gate is basically defined by a matrix T. So it's an invertible M by M matrix. And a simple example, an important example, is just a C0 gate. Okay, so you can easily verify that a C0 satisfies these properties. So C0 between any two qubits in the system. Okay, a bit more tricky are again these quadratic phase gates. So here is just again the definition, just to remind you what they are about. to give you an example, let's look at a single copy of Z2. So this is just a single qubit system. And look at the phase gate with diagonal elements 1i acting on a single qubit. So this by definition sends g to I raised to the power g times g. So this is a quadratic function because, well, if you see how this, can you actually read that on the top? Or yes or no? Yeah, okay. So if you see how this function acts on products of, on sums of group elements, then this is precisely the relation that you want to get by definition of a quadratic function. So this is, of course, quite easy to work out. So this single qubit phase gate is a quadratic phase gate that respects this definition. For two qubits, there is another example. So you can look at the standard controlled Z gate acting on two qubits. This sends two qubit computational basis state with this phase here. And also there you can see that this function satisfies this property that is given there. And then if you have m qubits, you can apply this gate to any single qubit in the system or this gate to any pair of qubits in the system. And they will always be quadratic phase gates. So what you find here is we have Hadamard gates, C naught, phase gates, and controlled Z gates. These are of course Clifford gates. So every Clifford circuit is in fact a normalizer circuit, and the other way around is also true. So basically the normalizer circuits over this group are precisely Clifford circuits. So in the end, this work is about generalizing the notion of Clifford circuits and their classical simulations to arbitrary finite abelian groups. That's cool. So then the second example is the single cyclic group. There the gates will be quite different. So as you recall, the Hilbert space is again 2 to the m dimensional, but there is no longer this factorization in terms of m single qubits. The quantum Fourier transform on this group is of course the standard one used, for example, in factoring algorithm. An automorphism is basically a map that multiplies a group element with some element A. And to ensure that this map is invertible, you have to restrict to those A's that are co-prime to 2 to the M. Okay, so that's somehow a multiplication gate. And then quadratic phase gates are slightly more complex. So again, they will be certain diagonal gates. So you can check that these gates respect this definition of quadratic phase gates. I guess there's not much more to say about that. So one thing I should mention is that we've seen that this Hilbert space associated with this group does not factorize anymore into a tensor product of m qubits. And as a result, the corresponding normalizer gates, they will no longer be local gates acting on a few qubits. So these gates are really global operations acting on the whole Hilbert space. Okay, so this was a definition of what these circuits are about. Now the main result. So the result is about classical simulations of these circuits. So to talk about classical simulations, you have to make clear what you mean by an efficient computation, classical or quantum. So in the standard way, by efficient, we mean a computation that has running time polylog in the number of elements of the group. So in the examples that we have considered, this means the same thing. So in both cases, efficient means polynomial in M. Okay, and then also correspondingly, if we talk about the polynomial size normalizer circuits, we will mean a circuit that has polylog of G normalizer gates in there. Okay, and then so somehow we have to be a bit careful here because, so generally speaking, if you do a classical simulation, the task is the following. Somebody tells you the description of a quantum circuit, of the input and of the measurement, and then given this classical information, you have to reproduce the outcome of the quantum computation. Now, if you have a standard quantum circuit acting, you know, with local gates and so on, it's quite obvious what the classical description of circuit should be, right? You just specify for each gate, you know, what the matrix elements are and on which qubits you act. But here you cannot really do that because many of these gates, as we saw before, they are global gates. So you cannot just specify all the matrix elements because this is inefficient. So, and in fact, it's not even obvious from the start that each of these gates does have an efficient classical description. So, but this turns out to be true, but you have to be careful with that. So just very briefly to sketch what these descriptions are for these gates. Of course, for a quantum Fourier transform, the description is quite obvious. You just state that you are doing a quantum Fourier transform. And if it's a partial Fourier transform, you just specify on which of the systems you're acting. for an automorphism gate, the way to specify that is to simply say how this corresponding automorphism acts on some generating set of the group, right? Every group has a small generating set, and you just specify the action of this map on these guys. So for a quadratic phase gate, it's again a bit more tricky. You have to, but still you can show that there is an efficient classical description. And this is because basically every quadratic function is uniquely determined by knowing how it acts on a basis and on sums of two elements of each of these bases. So to get an intuition why this is true, you should think basically as a quadratic function in the usual sense. So a quadratic function is basically given by a matrix, right? So you, something like that, right? And if you specify all these elements, you have to look at pairs, then you know the entire matrix, and there you know the entire quadratic function. So something similar happens here. And then finally, you should also make sure that every of these gates can in fact itself be realized efficiently on a quantum computer. Of course, for a quantum free transform, we know that. For the other gates, you have to show that. This all works, it's quite straightforward. So I won't show that here. Okay, that's somehow some of the pre-processing. Then what is the result? So the result is the following. You consider an arbitrary polynomial size normalizer circuit. The input can be any coset state, so which means you look at an arbitrary subgroup of the group G, and you look at a state that is given as an equal superposition over all elements in some coset of this group. And this state is described to you by just specifying X and a generating set of this subgroup. And then you measure in the standard basis. And then the statement is that there exists an efficient classical algorithm to sample this output distribution. And in fact, you sample this output distribution in an exact sense. So this result generalizes some previously known result, as I said before. So if you look at this group, and the corresponding normalizer circuits are the standard Clifford circuits. Therefore, this result generalizes the Gottesman-Mill theorem. What was also known previously is if you look at groups of this kind, so you have m copies of Zd, where d is some constant, then you have somehow a Gottesman-Mill theorem for q dits. This is also covered by this result. And I guess the new content of this result is everything that all other groups except for those. So for example, you could look at the cyclic group we were considering, right? So the corresponding normalizer circuits can be simulated classically in polynomial time in M. And then you can look at other things as well. Okay. How much time do I have left? Okay. Okay, so to discuss briefly the relation with the factoring algorithm. So just to recall, so I guess you all know that, what is a point in this problem where you want to factor a number? Let's say n is given as a product of two primes. You choose some a that is coprime to n, and then the steps of the factoring algorithm are the following ones. So you have basically two registers, a and b. A has basis states x that run through all of z 2 to the m, and B has basis states s that run through z to the n. Then in the first step, you prepare the 0,0 state. In the second step, you apply the quantum Fourier transform on the first register. Then you do modular exponentiation. Then you apply the quantum Fourier transform again, and then you measure. And then there is some classical post-processing. Okay, so the question is, how does all this relate to these normalizer circuits? Well, of course, you can just read off that all the steps except for the third one, they are fine within the normalizer gate formalism because the inputs you prepare, the measurements you do, and the quantum Fourier transform, they are allowed. So the only step that is not obviously allowed is this modular exponentiation. And in fact, you can also show that this will never be covered by this formalism. So you can show that modular exponentiation cannot be realized by any normalizer circuits, unfortunately. So the result is quite strong in the sense that not even a constant accuracy will do, and even an exponential size normalizer circuit will not do either. So it is simply that these normalizer circuits, they are not expressive enough to compute this kind of function, even if an exponentially long computation is allowed. So what is the basic idea, or what is the basic property that is somehow preventing this? It is the following. So if you have any function, so any permutation of the standard basis that is computed or realized by some normalizer circuit, then it will always have to be basically an automorphism, so a very linear function up to this constant h here. And of course, the exponential function is not of this kind. Okay, so somehow a bit more philosophically, you can now ask, well, what is now the essential quantum ingredient in the factoring algorithm, right? You know, people usually say, well, it is the quantum Fourier transform, because if you don't have the quantum Fourier transform, then the only thing that's left is modular exponentiation, and that is somehow a classical thing. Of course, by the same token, you could say, well, the thing that gives the factoring algorithm its power is precisely modular exponentiation, because if we don't have that, then all other elements are covered by this normalizer formalism. Of course, none of these two answers are very satisfying. So in the end, it's just that, you know, you combine these two operations, and that's what make that's what makes the whole algorithm work somehow. Okay, so very briefly, I'll give a sketch of the ingredients that go into the proof. The proof is quite lengthy, so I'll just have to be rather short here. So in many places you have to do rather basic computations within abelian, within finite abelian groups that I just list very briefly here. So for example, you should know that if you have two elements in the group, that you compute the group operation in polylog of g time. If you have a group element, that you can compute n times g efficiently. If you're given an automorphism in terms of its classical description, that you can evaluate its action. The same for a quadratic function, and so on. So these are somehow basic things. But there are also less basic things that you need to use. For example, given some subgroup of G, can you compute a generating set of the orthogonal subgroup of this group? So what is this orthogonal subgroup? So there is a notion of orthogonality that you can define for every such group by using these functions here. So they are called characters of the group. So given any element G of the group, you can associate with that a function from G to the complex numbers that sends H to this complex phase here. Okay, so that's what's called a character. And if you have any subgroup of the group G, you can associate with that this set H perpendicular, which is given by all group elements that for which the characters associated to the elements of H evaluate to one. And this set happens to be a subgroup, always, called the orthogonal subgroup of H. And then the question is, if you have a generating set of H, can you compute a generating set of the orthogonal subgroup? And this thing can be resolved efficiently, classically. Another kind of question you have to worry about is, given some automorphism specified in terms of its description, can you compute the action of the inverse of this automorphism? And also this you can do efficiently classically. And in the end, these two problems and some others, they are reduced to the fact that you can efficiently solve systems of linear Diophantine equations on a classical computer. So linear Diophantine equation, just a linear equation over the integers, basically. So you have an n times m integer matrix, an n dimensional integer vector. All entries are somehow bounded by 2 to the k, and then you can decide efficiently whether there exists an integer solution x, efficiently meaning polynomial time in the dimensions of the matrix and in the size of these integers. And moreover, if the answer is yes, then you can compute a generating set of solutions to this equation also efficiently. That's one of the main tools used there. Another element used in the proof is a generalization of Pauli and Clifford operators over finite abelian groups. So what's that about? So so you define basically generalizations of Pauli X's and Z's for finite abelian groups. Again, so here is this definition of these character functions. And then you define for every group element G corresponding XG operator, which just acts on this standard basis as a shift defined by G. This is the generalization of the Pauli X matrix. And then a generalization of a Pauli Z is a diagonal operator that just applies this character function as written there. Then given those guys, you can define Pauli operators by making products. So Pauli operator basically has this kind up to some global phase. And these Pauli operators, they form a group as in the qubit case. And then you show that for every normalizer gate and for every Pauli operator sigma, this this action of U on sigma will always again be a Pauli operator. And furthermore, the description of this operator can be computed efficiently. This is somehow, again, a generalization of the feature of Clifford circuits for qubits. So for qubits, this is quite easy to show. For arbitrary finite abelian groups, it's more technical. And this somehow also explains where the nomenclature normalizer circuits comes from, because this somehow shows that every normalizer gate belongs to the normalizer of the Pauli group in the unit. Okay, that's not that important. So then the idea is to use this property to show that the output state of every normalizer circuit is uniquely defined by equations of this kind. So it's kind of a stabilizer picture where these sigmas are Pauli operators. And then the idea is to use this description to have information about the form of this state, and then to use this insight in what the state looks like to do the simulation efficiently classically. So just to give you an idea of what concepts arise there, so an important thing is the group generated by these stabilizer generators, which is a stabilizer group. Another group that's important is this group P here, which is defined as follows. So for every stabilizer operator, which is a Pauli operator like so, you can look at its X part, so the X's that arise there, and you can collect them into a set, and that's P. And this also turns out to be a group. So this P is basically a collection of these XH operators, where H is some subset of the group G, and it turns out to be a subgroup of G, in fact. So that's kind of an important group. So it's a group of X operators. This means they are permutation matrices, which act on the standard basis. And then you need to look at orbits of this group. So since every X acts as a shift operator on the standard basis, an orbit of any element is just given by all the basis states that lie in some coset of H. Okay, and now somehow, the one observation is that every of these generators is a monomial operator. So a monomial operator is basically an operator that looks like a permutation matrix, but instead of having ones, you can have arbitrary phases. And just knowing that you have a state uniquely defined by these monomial operators implies that you can really have a good idea of what the final state looks like. So this state always has to be, and this is somehow a general property of these monomial operators, it always has to be a uniform superposition over one of the orbits of this group. So since the orbits are given like that, so you know that this final state, psi, will have to be a uniform superposition over a coset of this group H. Okay. So this means if you do a measurement on this state, that you will get a uniformly random element from this coset, because the superposition is uniform. So if you want to simulate this measurement, you have to figure out basically what this coset is. And this is somehow the hardest part in the proof, so to say. So to figure out what the coset is, you need to find first some generating set of this subgroup H. That's not very hard, because you know somehow that this H comes from the stabilizer generators. And if you know these generators, then you can quickly figure out what the corresponding generating set of the ages. The hard part somehow lies in figuring out which coset you're actually dealing with to find somehow this G. And this is somehow more technical. I won't go into details there because time is running out. So, and given this information, so a generating set of age and knowing which coset you have, then sampling from this coset is an easy task, and this somehow gives you the classical simulation. Okay, so this is my last slide now. So just to wrap up, so this result was about efficient classical simulations of normalizer circuits that have quantum free transforms as an essential component. Perhaps also I should say that we're looking into generalizations to non-abelian groups, and this is somehow the archive preprint of this work. Thank you.
So in the case of the Z 2 to the M.
So what is the M? Z 2 to the M or Z 2 to the M?
Oh, so Z
to so the cyclic group? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The quadratic phase gains, are these like a unitary transformations within the elements of the Heisenberg group?
You know? Yes, okay. Yes.
So the you said that all of the gates are in the normalizer of this generalized polygroup.
Right.
Is it exactly equal to the normalizer of the generalized polygroup, or are there some?
So go back. Sorry. Yeah. So I think if you have if you have groups, you know, ZD n times, then it is proven that it's everything.
Sure.
But other than that, I haven't really bothered proving it. I would be very surprised if it's not. I couldn't think of anything that you could add there, but I don't know. Yeah.
A fair number of these ingredients kind of sound familiar for people thinking about stabilized circuits.
Mm-hmm.
Can you condense what was like the new trick that you had to invent to get here?
Well, so I don't think that the proof that I use is not, if you would even restrict to qubits, I don't think it's a standard proof to prove the corresponding theorem. So the way of how you look at these stabilizer operators and how you learn from there what the state looks like, I don't think that this is how it's usually done. Yeah, so that would be the new element, I think. So basically this part. So given these stabilizers, how do you know what the state looks like? And then knowing that that you have this superposition over a coset state, how do you find what the coset is? I think that would be relatively new.
So in your simulation at the end, you sample from the measurement statistics. So suppose mm-hmm. instead you wanted to output the probability of a given outcome. Do you think that would be possible in
yes.
the bottom of time?
Yes, I think it is. We're working on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you go back to those slides I'll show you?
Which one?
This one?
Yeah.
So I, it's more like a comment, not a question, but I just found it surprising that basically what you're saying is that using your techniques, you can simulate all steps except step number three. But on the other hand, this step number three is purely classical. It's just one of the explanation. So it's like there is one kind of simulation for all these other steps, and there is another kind of simulation for step three. But then once you have these two kind of things together, then it's not clear if there's like a joint simulation.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I guess I would not easily call this step a classical step because after all you do it in superposition. Of course it's Toffoli gates, but
these Toffoli gates are classical. Oh, okay.
Yeah, but yeah. So that would mean you would say that the quantum Fourier transform is the only quantum step. I would say it's somehow the fact that you combine these things in superposition, that's what makes the simulation hard, so to say.
So if we go back to other QFT simulation results that you listed on your first slide,
right?
So do they apply to any some broader class of transformations that includes QFT, or they apply just to QFT?
So by QFT you still mean quantum Fourier transforms?
Yes.
So you mean these tensor network methods?
Yes.
So they are quite general. So they are certainly not restricted to quantum Fourier transforms. So they basically apply to any circuit that where the structure, so the topology of the graph of the circuit, has a certain well-behaved property. So it should have small tree width. And that's what you need. Yeah. Does this answer the question?
Yeah.
Thanks.
So this will be the last question, and then I think we need to move on. To the
so you mentioned something about the possible generalizations for non-abelian groups. I mean, it's well, it's clear. Over some groups you can perform on the Fourier transform to extent, but what could be the analog of your quadratic case or automorphism you can simulate in classical simulation for non-abelian groups?
So. So I think in general that would be very hard. So,
yeah, but just for a restricted class.
So we are not quite there yet. I would guess the definition may have to be rather tailored to the specific non-abelian group that you're looking at. So not this kind of general statement that holds for all groups. And then I don't think I could give you like a single shot explanation.
Okay, so let's thank Martin again.